So welcome to our Faith and Narrative panel. I realize it's very late in the end of Sunstone, so thank you for sticking it out and coming. We will have four presenters. I am going to start. I am Sheila Taylor. Online I go by Lynette, and I blog once in a while at Zalofa Head's Daughters. I am studying systematic theology, and I am supposed to right now be writing a dissertation, but here I am at Sunstone. So, then next we will have Sarah Burlingame, who is also known online as Crazy Woman Creek, and she is a Mormon feminist atheist. Exciting combination. Then we are going to hear from Kimberly Lewis, who was an LDS convert of 16 years from a multi-faith background and an FMH blogging enthusiast. And she's a nurse, and she lives in Connecticut with her four children. So she's got a fun background to bring to this. And then finally we'll have Joanna Brooks, who at this point I'm not sure needs an introduction because this is her fifth or something panel to be on. But in case you haven't heard of her before, despite her fame, she chairs the Department of English and Complet at San Diego State and blogs a bunch about Mormonism also. So that will be our format. Then we'll have questions. Since I'm the moderator, I'll be watching the time, but there's no one to moderate me. So I have four siblings in the audience, and I'm inviting them to tell me to stop if I'm talking too long.
That's enough already.
All right, thanks. I'll be done now. To be created in God's image, says theologian C.S. Song, is the power to tell stories, the power of imagination, and the power of words. Narrative plays a central role in human life and identity. In my work in theology in recent years, I have been particularly interested in the role played by narrative in Christianity, both narratives of the community and people's individual life narratives. In this paper, I would like to mention a few ways in which I think a narrative perspective contributes to theological questions and suggest how these might apply to a specifically LDS context. Recent decades have witnessed a rising interest in what has been dubbed narrative theology. The Christian message, such theologians have pointed out, is not an argument, but a story. In Christianity, the central narratives which tell us about God are those which tell of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. For Christians, then, Jesus is the paradigmatic story. And it is precisely these stories, rather than propositional truth claims, which are at the heart of the tradition. The church explains itself using story. It is narrative that defines the community and holds it together. As theologian Johann Metz observed, Christians do not primarily form an argumentative and reasoning community, but a storytelling community. What grounds the church is not a set of abstract principles, but stories about its identity in which the members participate. Why is narrative such a necessary element of Christian faith? This kind of communication is inevitable, says Reinhold Niebuhr, because of our nature as historical beings. Christianity tells of a revelation which is encountered in history and which must therefore be articulated in narrative terms. God speaks to us in the concretions of time, place, and people. What we know of God is mediated through the particularities of our history, through our culture, through our language. The radical claim of Christianity is that God actually came to us and lived with us in human history. We encounter the divine in the concrete histories of our personal lives, not in some separate ethereal spiritual realm. We do not find God by escaping history. Rather, we meet God in history. Another reason for the necessity of narrative in faith is that Christians understand God as being in some sense a person. This is, of course, even a stronger claim in the LDS flavor of Christianity. And we do not understand persons through abstract statements. We understand them through narratives. To know who God is, we look to the stories in which God acts as a character. The narrative quality of Christian faith can also be seen in its eschatological focus. Christian teachings describe the redemption of human history. We understand ourselves in the terms of the traditions and history of our faith, and also in terms of an anticipated future. As Brian Horn puts it, caught between memory and hope, life becomes inescapably narrative. A particularly significant point about narratives of faith is that the truths conveyed by a narrative are to some degree inseparable from the narrative form in which they are located. This raises questions about the traditional tendency to articulate truths in the form of propositional statements. Narratives are not simply one form of conveying ideas, which could be equally well articulated in other forms of language. Their truths cannot be pulled out of a story and restated in other ways without losing something. The stories related in our scripture cannot be boiled down to some one-sentence moral. I would argue that rather than illustrating truths that are conveyed more directly in propositional language, which I think is how our manuals are set up, it'll be like, here's our doctrine, this is the real thing, and here's some stories, kind of secondarily. Often the converse is the case. The propositional language is a limited attempt to make sense of what we hear in the stories. One of the perennially vexing problems of Mormonism has to do with boundary maintenance. What exactly does it mean to be a Mormon? At what point are your beliefs different enough that they are outside the tradition, no longer recognizably Mormon? This is, of course, a particularly challenging question in our faith because of the difficulty of establishing what is in fact official doctrine, if indeed there can be said to be such a thing. Are you outside the bounds of orthodoxy if you are, say, a Trinitarian, if you are a feminist, if you reject Book of Mormon historicity, if you reject polygamy, or conversely, if you still advocate it? In a tradition in which it is so difficult to identify orthodoxy, is it even possible to be heterodox? I think it is important to engage these questions. I resist attempts to dilute the term Mormon to the extent that it can mean any set of beliefs whatsoever. But I wonder, rather than trying to articulate some kind of list of particular truth claims that one must accept to be considered a believing Latter-day Saint, it might be helpful to draw on this narrative approach and consider Mormons as a storytelling community. As Douglas Davies observes, history within Mormonism often plays the role occupied in other traditions by theology. Our community, I would argue, is founded not on unique propositional truth claims, though we certainly do have them, but rather on the narratives of the Restoration. In fact, we have a tradition of wariness, of creeds. In the LDS faith, I see two central narrative clusters: the New Testament narratives mentioned earlier, which we share with the rest of Christianity, and the narratives unique to Mormonism. In the contemporary church, I would propose that the most prominent restoration narratives are the First Vision and the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. I might also add the Pioneer Trek West. We tell these stories to investigators and repeat them in our worship services. To be a Mormon, whether or not one is a first-generation Mormon or can trace their lineage to Brigham Young, is to be a part of that history. And moving to a more theological level, the story that most fundamentally grounds an LDS worldview is that of the plan of salvation, a story of a premortal existence and a postmortal judgment, a narrative background that we bring to make sense of life here. Given this, I am always somewhat taken aback when stories get downplayed as being somehow lesser than truth claims articulated in propositional form, as if the latter were more pure. I notice this tendency in critiques of testimonies which include stories, because they're supposed to be straight testimony, like which is what, reciting the Articles of Faith? I don't know. Or in a comment I find bizarre, people apologizing for being personal and sharing stories. Oh, the horror. As a systematic theologian, I obviously believe very much in the value of attempting to articulate and re-articulate our truth claims. Yet I think we lose something if we see those articulations as somehow more core than our stories. I would also note in passing that it makes for very boring church meetings, if we can. I personally struggle to express my beliefs in the form of propositional statements. When I do make those kind of assertions, I always end up second-guessing myself and wondering if I really do believe X or Y. When people ask me what I believe, I notice that instead of trying to come up with doctrinal formulations, I frequently find myself relating a narrative about how I've seen God involved in my life. I may struggle to make a statement of definitive knowledge that the church is true, but I can tell you the story of why I am a member. And engaging with believers of other faiths, I note that I'm far more interested in the stories they tell about what it means to be, say, a Catholic, than a recitation of the catechism. I would like now to turn to another way in which I think a narrative perspective is helpful in considering theological claims. In my own work, I am particularly interested in questions of sin and salvation. Christianity offers, one might say, salvific narratives. Yet narratives can also be destructive. And this framework, I think, is a helpful way of thinking about the effects of original sin. The classic debate on this question is the 5th century dispute between Augustine and Pelagius, which has shaped discussion of this question in Western Christianity ever since. The Pelagians argued that humans exist in a kind of morally neutral space in which they can choose to do good or choose to do evil. Freedom then refers to the ability to opt for one or the other of these choices. The will does not incline in any particular direction. This Pelagian notion of freedom is common in the modern world, and I think in Mormonism, in which freedom is understood in terms of autonomy. For Augustine, by contrast, the will is never neutral. It is always inclined in some direction. It does not exist in some isolated, detached sphere from which it surveys good and evil and then makes a choice between them. Rather, it is inherently connected to desire, as our actions are always motivated by some belief about what is good and an inclination in that direction. Sin, in the Augustinian framework, then, is a distortion of the will, rather than an autonomous will opting for evil over good. We not only sin, we find ourselves in sin. As Paul Ricoeur puts it, if any one of us initiates evil, inaugurates it, something Pelagius saw very well, each of us also discovers evil, finds it already there, in himself, outside himself, and before himself. I find this Augustinian approach to sin and freedom to be strikingly resonant with a narrative perspective. To talk about finding ourselves in sin has to do with the kinds of narratives into which we are born and which we appropriate. We cannot examine human acts in isolation, for our actions are always embedded in stories, and therefore, like the stories, have a teleological element, are aimed at our particular purpose, are guided by certain values. And the narratives in which we live convey the nature of the good, the norms by which we make judgments, and in this way shape our freedom. To be ensnared in sin does not mean that we have lost our ability to choose between alternatives. Rather, the problem is that our relation to these alternatives has been distorted. I realize that was somewhat abstract, and I'm probably committing the sin I said earlier of being boring because I was all abstract. But there's a feminist payoff here, so that's why it was worth it to follow it. Because despite its rejection of certain aspects of Augustinian thought, feminist theology includes a strong sense of inherited sin in its critique of problematic patriarchal structures, which have been passed on throughout history. The problem, then, is not that a system like patriarchy overcomes or stifles the will, leaving us unable to choose. The problem is that this form of social distortion shapes the will itself, that we live in narratives which convey hierarchical issues or ideas about gender. In an LDS context, I frequently hear the point that despite this hierarchy, women still have their agency, the ability to choose. They can, after all, decide not to follow. But even setting aside some of the other problems of this formulation, of which I think there are several, I think we need a more nuanced consideration of what it even means to choose in a narrative context already shaped by patriarchy. And I'd like to pursue that in further feminist theology. But I will now move to a slightly happier topic and talk a little about grace. How can we talk about grace from a narrative perspective? Christianity, as I said earlier, offers salvific narratives. And one reason why narratives can be so powerful is that they have the ability to convey ideas in a way that makes them more accessible than other forms of communication. As Jack Priestley explains, to know directly is to have a concept, to know with a conscious mind. To know indirectly is to have had the imagination stimulated by a new image. The latter has a power that the former lacks. The simple statement, greed kills, may sum up the moral point of the story, but that is all it does do. What it does not do is to forge a link between knowing and acting. A story, on the other hand, engages the imagination. We can intellectually comprehend truth without being at all changed by it. But when we imaginatively enter into a story, we in a sense experience it ourselves, allowing for the possibility of transformation. In the words of Paul Ricoeur, an encounter with a narrative has the potential to transform our own life as we bring its possible world into the world in which we live. Stories, says Alice Walker, differ from advice, and that once you get them, they become a part of the fabric of your whole soul. That is why they heal you. We do not escape our own reality through such a narrative encounter. Rather, we have the experience of seeing it through different eyes. We find it described in unfamiliar and in perhaps unsettling ways, ways which force us to reconsider our own understandings and assumptions. Flannery O'Connor once commented that the challenge for the Christian novelist is that he will find in modern life distortions which are repugnant to him, and his problem will be to make these appear as distortions to an audience which is used to seeing them as natural. I think, again, Mormon feminists could have fun with that. Narrative has the potential to change us because the world it opens up for us is not just once upon a time, it is our world too. But it is our world in a way in which we have not previously seen it, and this new vision allows for transformative possibilities. The work of grace, says feminist theologian Serene Jones, is in undoing and remaking us. Thinking of this as a narrative process, one way of exploring this dynamic is to look at what happens when narratives break down and what is involved in their reconstruction. I here draw on the example of trauma, which is closely associated with disruptive and disintegrative life narratives. A characteristic feature of traumatic memories is that they are not grounded in time or in narrative. Such memories are simultaneously too vividly present and too elusive. They surface when they are not wanted, but they might also be inaccessible when one attempts to explore them. They lack proper tense. And because it disrupts narrative, trauma also disrupts meaning. Traumatic events can produce a crisis in which previously taken for granted connections, ones between events, people, plans, aims, objectives, values, and beliefs, are shattered, leaving what has been referred to as narrative wreckage. Trauma is therefore an experience that calls for the construction of new narratives. For this reason, treatment often emphasizes storytelling, which involves situating the traumatic events in a narrative, and therefore in time. Through the process of telling and retelling the story, the memory is transformed and integrated. One important aspect of narrative reconstruction, then, is integration. Significantly, this does not involve constructing simple, tidy narratives in which everything neatly fits together, without any loose ends or jagged edges. Painful events cannot simply be erased or excluded from the story. In fact, it is precisely when they are excluded that they have such destructive power. The goal of this work is therefore not to collapse the disparate events of the narrative into a facile harmony, but to find ways to hold discordant events together in a narrative whole. This description of recovery from trauma has striking parallels to what Christians have traditionally understood as the work of grace. One of the ways in which sin ensnares us lies in its ability to keep us trapped in the past. It can hold a person in bondage through the power that the past continues to exert on the present. In what way, then, is there hope for redemption? This can be seen in the example of trauma I just mentioned, in which by narrating about past events, the person changes his or her relationship to them and what they mean to him or her in the present. Grace, we might say, can deal with the past by rethinking it in a way that eliminates its destructive influence on the present. And salvation is often described in terms of wholeness, of reuniting that which has been estranged. What can unite these disparate pieces? Dietrich Bonhoeffer writes, "When one confronts the partial and incomplete nature of almost every aspect of existence, only in the final analysis, only God can make of those fragments something that can be definitively called a life." From a narrative perspective, the love of God might be described as the unifying pattern which is able to incorporate even the most disjunctive elements of a life. This is a process which centrally involves the imagination. One thinker makes the intriguing suggestion that the fall is actually a fall of imagination. It limits our possibilities, impoverishes our imaginative abilities. Grace mediated through religious narratives has the ability to widen those limits. Revelation can heal the imagination, open it up to new possibilities, lead us to richer narratives. Because we can imagine, we are not prisoners of the narratives in which we live. We can transcend them. Ricoeur describes narrative as a discordant concordance. To be a coherent story, it must have continuity, but to be a story with a plot, it must have discontinuity or change. Narrative thus has the ability to hold together continuity and change, discordance and concordance. And a challenge in this process of integration, as in recovery from trauma, is to not collapse these discordant elements of a life into too easy concordance. To produce a truly integrating and healing narrative, suffering and evil must be seriously engaged, not hastily smoothed over or avoided altogether. We cannot jump straight to the resurrection and gloss over the crucifixion. Life continually poses challenges to the desire for orderly narratives. The power of grace, then, lies in its ability not to erase all contradictions, but rather to hold them together. Mormons, I think, have a tendency to want our narratives to be neat, to have all problems tidied up, as if the ability to do this constituted evidence of the truthfulness of the gospel. Yet from the perspective of the LDS narrative of the plan of salvation, I would argue that a crucial aspect of living in mortality is in fact living in a situation of ambiguity. And one of our challenges as Mormons, but also simply as humans, is to live in the messiness of narratives, to not rush too quickly to a narrative that glosses over the rough edges. On perhaps a similar note, I think our tradition is less rich than it could be when there are only a few available narrative templates. I know that some of my moments of feeling most alienated from the church have not come from hearing doctrines I found challenging to accept, though that has certainly been difficult at times, but from not recognizing myself in any of the stories I read in the Ensign or hear over the pulpit. When I hear story after story about selfless and angelic women, I begin to wonder what kind of creature I am and if the church is even aware of women like me. I cannot even begin to locate myself in such narratives. Another narrative which I have struggled in vain to map to my life is the classic crisis of faith story, in which belief is followed by some kind of crisis, and then a resolution in which one either gains a testimony and is more deeply grounded in the church, or leaves the church. Growing up, I assumed this plot would at some point unfold in my life, so I kind of waited for it. However, my relationship to the church has never followed this pattern. If I could frame my various doubts and concerns as a crisis of faith, and I'm not sure that's even the best phrase, it is something ongoing, and it seems more circular than linear. My belief regularly waxes and wanes, and I cannot speak either my faith or my doubts in the past tense as bits of an earlier journey. I need a different story. When I was a teenager, I read the novels of Haim Potok, and was simply blown away. I was stunned to encounter stories that resonated with me so deeply. In retrospect, I was starved for alternate narratives than the ones I was hearing at church. Potok's book suggested to me a way of thinking about a more complicated relationship to one's religious community than an either-or in which you believe or you don't. You accept everything or you leave. You are a believer or an apostate. I hadn't encountered narratives which suggested other possibilities. They gave me hope. And as I have wrestled with various aspects of my relation to Mormonism over the years, I have found that the thing that has been the most helpful has been not to hear answers, but to hear stories from other Latter-day Saints that have let me know I was not alone. For this reason, among others, I think it is vital that we tell our stories, with all of their uncertainties and loose ends and even contradictions. In fact, I would like to float the possibility that this is not simply a nice thing to do. It is actually part of the LDS purpose of life. One of the reasons we came here, we are told, is to learn. And I would argue that this is not so much propositional knowledge, which surely we could have achieved much more efficiently in the premortal life, but rather experiential knowledge. One might even say narrative knowledge.
Yeah, they're clapping in synchronicity.
We were clapping
louder. Okay. I'm going to have to call on Kimmy and Beth. Can you pass the sacrament?
Sure. Uh-oh, the apostate session.
It's
hard. It's not a statement that you're more standing.
Hey, yeah, we want the sacrament too. Aren't we supposed to get it first?
You're the presiding bishop?
Yes, I want it first.
We better take it.
This is still, you guys can hear this? This is on? Oh, wait, don't eat. As the cup is passed, please take a piece of chocolate, but do not eat it yet. This would have worked better if it wasn't at the end of the day. So now that we've all practically received the Holy Sacrament from our able deacons, I'd like you all to lick or nibble a portion, but not the entirety, of your chocolate.
I hope this isn't a lesson about chastity.
And gentlemen, this chocolate... Did I get a piece?
I have some dark.
Okay, that's what I want.
I want dark too.
So this chocolate is your intellectual integrity. And someday you're going to meet someone that you will love very much. And when that day comes, you will want to have a whole and unsmirched chocolate to offer them. That we can refrain from tainting our chocolate is by not slandering people who believe differently than we do. So I hope this has been a meaningful and deeply impressive lesson for you, as it has almost nothing to do with the talk that I have prepared. I counted on the old adage that there is nothing that the LDS love more than a good object lesson, relevant or not. Here's some chocolate. So
the restroom right now?
Yeah, can eat the rest of it now. If that's how you feel about your intellectual integrity, then yes. So I wanted to talk to you about faith and personal narrative today, and I thought that a good place to begin was my own story. Having been raised a Baha'i by my parents, I floundered as a teenager experimenting with Christianity, New Ageism, Buddhism, and perhaps most memorably for those around me, my brief and horrific phase as a goddess worshiper, a very vocal goddess worshiper. And by the age of 16, I'd resigned myself to what felt like my true calling of atheism. And I remained a staunch defender of atheism until I came across an article in Bust Magazine exploring the curious phenomena of Mormon feminism. I read the blog, I began to meet the women who wrote for it in real life, and even as I maintained my belief that there was no God, my curiosity about the peculiar people grew. And I agreed to take the discussions, which naturally led to my conversion. A testimony of the Book of Mormon, my baptism surrounded by my once skeptical family, who, inspired by my powerful example, chose baptism themselves. Not really. Everything but that last part is true. But even I recognize the resonance of that story. When I relate my actual story, which I will get to in a moment, I can hear the devout silently penciling in, sketching in the right ending. The only ending that makes sense out of my participation in their religion. And sometimes that narrative is so powerful that I feel the pull of it myself, forgetting that I'm speaking for the most part of what you all are doing and not what we all are doing in the church. So my true story is that I'm an atheist and a feminist who came to Mormonism because of that feminism and not in spite of it. I first read an article about Lisa Butterworth in her blog, Feminist Mormon Housewives, in Bust Magazine in 2007. And the way I came to the blog also has a long and distinguished pedigree in personal narrative. I was the enlightened do-gooder. No less ridiculous than that great scene in the memoir Cheaper by the Dozen when the Margaret Sanger Society representative shows up at the Gilbreth household to preach the good word with their 12 children. Here I am, ladies. Hold on to your hats. I'm going to teach you about real feminism. And I was spared the humiliation of making too big of an ass of myself by the sheer good luck of having been raised with good manners. Wait! Wait to make an ass of yourself until you know these people a little bit better, I was instructed. To my parents' credit. So that wasn't my story either, the atheist who brought enlightenment to those sad, oppressed Mormon women. And I do make light of that idea, but in truth, I find that narrative just as destructive as the unfulfilled godless heathens who aren't complete humans until they embrace the gospel narrative. The other powerful narrative that intersects with mine is that of the ex-Mormon. In theory, I have the most in common with those who see the church as outsiders and are critical of their truth claims. It is a connection that quickly crumbles when pressed beyond the easy questions of, don't I find the concepts of patriarchy offensive? Yes. Yes, I do. Isn't the bureaucracy behind ceilings and this middle management style of the hereafter that is embraced by some LDS patently absurd to you? Yeah, I'm afraid I agree. But nowhere in that story is there room for more than a reluctant acknowledgement of the power of women blessing their own babies. The pull of our innate connection to the divine trumping a lifetime of intense social conditioning. And nowhere in that story is there room for the LDS pioneer experience that echoes every saga of exile and redemption that we know. Where in that story is my own powerful attraction to the particular grace and salvation that I have found only in fleeting moments of community? That mystery that we enter into when we aren't looking for it or expecting it, but nonetheless can't deny. How good it feels to sit in a subway station far from home and share your real and metaphorical scars with another woman whose life is both nothing like my own and in ways that are essential in that moment, a mirror to suffering and redemption that I have felt. And in that moment, the fact that we use very different language to understand those concepts seems laughably immaterial. Since I have found myself outside of the atheist-turned-convert story popularized by Lee Strobel, C.S. Lewis, and every issue of The Ensign that I have ever picked up. And likewise, feeling very little connection to the Richard Dutchers of the world, or even Dawkins and Hitchens with their dismissive snideness regarding this faith, I was left to cobble together my own story, which of course is not wholly my own story, since it echoes the story of outsiders everywhere, which in a grand irony brings me back full circle to connecting with the still outsider status of Mormons in mainstream society.
Ha.
I have told this story before, but I'll tell it again. My epiphany came sitting in my car listening to the secular version of conference talks, National Public Radio. I had recently been elected to the Democratic National Convention as an Obama delegate for Wyoming. I was struggling with my decision to identify as a queer delegate. Being in a heterosexual marriage, the question of my queerness rarely, if ever, came up. But the DNC, Tree tells me I have to enunciate for a Mormon audience, because you always hear DNC as D-N-C. But the DNC wanted to know, how much diversity could they claim? Was I a member of a union? A non-white Hispanic? Wheelchair-bound? No. But before I checked the box to affirm that, yes, hetero marriage or not, I was and am a queer woman, I had to perform the secular version of climbing Jacob's ladder and wrestling with the twin demons of appropriation and collusion. How could I claim my place in a community whose identity I'd abdicated? I'd answered the first part of that question by acknowledging that I was already dying by the sword, so I may as well live by the sword a little. That is, I did out myself when I would face at best awkwardness and at worst open hostility. It wouldn't kill me to get a little gay swag, rub elbows with Gavin Newsom, and receive that bittersweet applause and affection you receive when people know you are queer and from Wyoming, the home of that sweet-faced boy whose crucified body was found propped against that ubiquitous Wyoming barbed wire. So I openly identified as a queer delegate and began fielding questions from fellow delegates, reporters, and friends. And I spoke as honestly and succinctly as I could. Yep, I was married to a man. Yep, I'd had previous relationships with women. And no, I didn't plan on leaving my husband now that I was a queer. But I was still conflicted about what that meant and the extent to which I could claim the title if I wasn't living it. Which brings me to my car and NPR and the Palestinian woman shilling her latest book on Talk of the Nation. It was a mild spring day, my baby was sleeping in the back seat, and my brain was only half engaged in this woman's story of her childhood in Palestine. But the tone of her voice, the rich, deep tenor and those thick, rolling R's did make an impression, because the thought occurred to me, huh, that woman's voice gives me a real testimony of my queerness. And in that moment, I realized two things. One, I was perfectly at peace with the fluidity of my sexuality. And two, I had spent so much time around Mormons that I had incorporated not just your jargon, but the worldview that came with it. That I, Sarah Burlingame, had the right to ask and receive revelation. And if that revelation came from National Public Radio, all the better. So the revelation was deeper than that for me. It was proof of the level that I had assimilated Mormonists, but it was also my roadmap into reconciling my status as an atheist immersed and in love with Mormon people. If I could be a queer, hetero-married Obama delegate from the great state of Wyoming, why not an atheist who loved Mormons? It was possibly the least bizarre part of my identity. And I'm completely kidding about that last part, because I could sprout horns, bow three times a day to Hong Kong, and declare the divinity of Lady Gaga, and my secular friends would find it far more palatable than my love and contact with the LDS. Obviously. So while I stated earlier that my good manners helped pave the way for my initial contact with Mormon feminism, I want to give proper credit to the role arrogance has played in this peculiar relationship. There is a certain arrogance in presuming that my sometimes incoherent story has something to say to people already struggling to resolve the dissonance with their own lives. But whether you generously refer to it as an abundance of confidence or uncharitably see it as sheer arrogance, I've got it. It's not so much a faith in my own intellect or goodness, and certainly not my appropriateness, as much as it is my confidence that I know a good story when I hear it.
Whoa.
Whoa. Immersion in LDS stories, I believe that I know the language in a way that can only be seen from the inside. For instance, I often hear from secular feminists, why don't Mormon feminists just withhold their membership, rob the church of their participation, their money, and certainly, and perhaps most critically, their children from the church until the church changes? And as a narrative, that could look like this. Christ died. The church fell into apostasy. Joseph Smith received a vision and subsequently restored the gospel, but it was incomplete. Due to the fallen nature of men, they neglected to fully include women in this restoration. Satan whispered into the ear of the prophet, urging him to consider only the needs of half of God's marvelous creation. And the prophet complied. Finally, a band of valiant Mormon women, through prayer and fasting, decided to fight the church, publish polemics against it, and withdraw their favors, a la Lysistrata, from their priesthood-holding husbands. The prophet relented, recognized the divine nature of their calling, and now men and women jointly hold the priesthood in the LDS faith. I can't imagine a less Mormon story if I tried. But I can and have imagined what that story could look like. Imagine if her story was this. Christ died. The church fell into apostasy. Joseph Smith received a vision and restored the gospel, but it was incomplete. Because the world wasn't ready to hear the divine nature of women that mirrored their heavenly mother. When the kingdom had been built on earth by righteous men and righteous women, Heavenly Mother began to reveal herself to ordinary men and women. Appearances of Heavenly Mother came to be expected in nightly dreams and tedious sacrament meetings. She is gracious. At first, they were whispers, the image of a swollen womb, a caress on your temple that felt curiously like your mother's when you were alone in the car worrying about where this month's mortgage was going to come from. And the whisper became a crescendo until God's people could no longer deny that they had a Heavenly Mother and she was aching to talk with them. The prophet heard so unceasingly from his flock, wanting to make sense of these dreams, that he began to pray daily and finally hourly for direction. It was then that the prophet received the revelation that Mother in Heaven had been trapped in a prison of humanity's making. And because she allowed for the free agency of her people, she would not be released from it until her people grew and ached enough to know her in return. And so it came to pass that men and women jointly held the priesthood in the LDS faith and pray openly to their heavenly parents. Now that's a Mormon story. And it's a story that I want to play a minor role in. If there is a place for someone like me who loves your stories and your valiant hearts, I want to claim that role. Messy, dissonant, and hard to explain. Practically Mormon. And I'd like to close by reading a poem that I wrote driving out here. It's called Prayer to a God in Whom I Do Not Believe. I don't have my own words, so I had to borrow yours. My people never hide to Kolob. We didn't feel the need. We knew what it was like to be hungry, but bread stayed bread. And wine was more than enough without becoming blood. I never cared for your confining spaces, sterile baptism pools, or your creed that concludes meetings without end. But I need your people, Lord, more than desire it. If this is a battle, must I acknowledge that you've won? This world may be a testing ground, and the men and women I want beside me belong to you. And I say this in my own name. Amen.
Amen.
That's Sarah, isn't she great? Well, in thinking about what I had to say about faith and narrative, there were three separate starts on this talk, and all of them were, I guess you could say, undermined by computers and printers not talking. And so I figured I was going to end up with the outline that I started with, and I was going to go from that. And I thought a lot about narrative, especially in listening to what Sarah was saying, and that my life has been spectacularly messy, and how difficult it has been since I've converted in translating that messiness into a form that could be understood by what has become increasingly more confining to me in some ways. Let me start with the fact that, in short, my background, I grew up in abuse. I grew up with my father, a raging alcoholic. My mother was in despair. She became severely depressed. And then she ended up picking herself up, dusting herself off, going back to school, and successfully supporting us. It was a long road to that. My family has since healed, and I really put it down to narrative. That may seem like a strange thing to say, but part of it is that I was somewhat of a freak in my family. We came from a whole different direction. The religions within my family were diverse. My mother was Catholic. My father was Protestant, still is. Grandmother, Congregational. We have a Quaker. It's just all over the place. But one of the things that happened in a couple of generations before mine was that there had been real harm that had come through not tolerating different religions within the family. My grandparents kept their marriage secret. She was a Finn Protestant, and my father was an Irish Catholic, and neither side of the family was thrilled by that. So they kept it a secret until my grandmother became pregnant with her first child, because there's no hiding it at that point. And then my grandfather, who'd been a happy Catholic, the day that Nancy was born, their first child, the Catholic priest came in and said that unless my grandmother converted and that child was baptized Catholic, that he was officially declaring that child a bastard that day. And that was the end of my grandfather's attendance. I can't say he converted to Protestantism, but he became a disaffected Catholic is what he did. And then henceforth, within the family, it was pretty much just determined in our collective narrative that religion was not going to trump our personal relationships, period. They were not going to intrude in that holy ground. However messy we were, that was something that we did get straight. My father, he was absent through his alcoholism, but the times he was present, it was devastating. Somehow, starting at age 4, with people that I knew, because my mother was largely gone and I was raised essentially by my grandmother and babysitters, I just ran into a very select group of people who seemed to be in position at strategic times of my life. I had always had this quest to find not so much religion as a direct relationship to God. And starting at age 4, I was taught to pray, and I enjoyed it. I loved church. I loved the ritual of it. It didn't matter which one you put me in, I loved it. I was so happy. It was the only place I felt safe. And I was one of the lucky children that saw God not as some reflection of my angry alcoholic father, because that does happen to some people. It happened to my brother. But God was the example of what my father would be if alcohol weren't in the way. He had every attribute that I needed for a loving, nurturing father to bring me along that I wasn't finding in my family of origin. And that's safe and comforting. And I also drew very heavily on examples of strong women in the Bible. I was very lucky that my best friend was Jewish, and her family also all lived with her. I mean, 3 generations lived with her, and all 3 generations were friends with 3 generations of my family. in keeping with our philosophy of respect for what people had to personally believe to get through this life. I attended high holidays with them. I attended Shabbat. I went to synagogue. I went to Torah class. It was so enriching to bring those old narratives into my life. I learned to love the Old Testament even when it confused me. There's plenty confusing in it. The New Testament I got from the Catholic and the Episcopalian upbringing I had, because I did double duty. Rather than my parents saying, oh, you know, children who know nothing about religion, go pick one, they decided instead to say, well, you can go to both. And since you'll know what both are, you can choose what's best for you. And that's another reason why they allowed me to attend with my Jewish friend, because they didn't mind if I became Jewish either. So, which I didn't, but my friend tells me I'm an honorary Jew. And she also says I'm a better Jew than she is, which is ironic. But so those narrative influences for me that I could find in Scripture were very comfortable, because to me, in a family that was crazy all around me, I was finding examples of what I should be trying to attain. Did I really know how to do that? Not exactly. But it did help me not internalize everything that was happening around me. And I think it left me a lot more whole than it left my brother. My brother ended up feeling that with wish list prayer, that if there was indeed a God, with what we were going through, he couldn't be a very nice one. And rather than believe that this being that was supposed to be so helpful to us really existed and wasn't being helpful, it was more useful to him for healing to believe he wasn't there. And I respect that view as well. I think the strongest understanding I came of what narrative can do in our lives was when my father got sober. It was the day before I left for the Army. I was saying goodbye to him. We had had... He'd actually had a revelatory moment of his own. He had insisted that he hadn't said or acted a certain way that I had told him he had. So I got the bright idea, being a sassy teenager, of recording him. And I played it back. And he just sat there. Because I can't explain this to you. I know a lot of people can't separate when they... If I were to give details of the specific evils that he had committed. And yeah, sometimes they were evil. I can say that I faced evil sometimes. My father was the nicest person I've ever met in my life. Add a drop of alcohol, and I don't know. It was a transformation. Not a good one. So when he heard it, it was intensely painful to him because he couldn't relate to it, because he would drink so much that he would black out. Be so, you know... If you were a person who was naturally nice and kind and people who were telling you that you'd said things that in your right mind you'd never say in a million years, of course you're going to deny it. I'd never say that. And then he heard that he had. And he heard the voice he said it in. I said goodbye to him, and I remembered I said, well, now, Dad, I'm the last person in your life. And I'm saying goodbye. So, I had... the best drill instructors in the world. I know. Does that sound bizarre? I love them both to this day. I don't know why I got those particular drill sergeants, but they were phenomenal. I hadn't told them anything, and I was excelling. I was doing very well because, you know, a large part of my recovery, a large thing that I really identify with is perfecting the saints. I think for a while, I was working with the narrative that if I was good enough, successful enough, strong enough, made all the right choices, then I was going to wake up one day at the end of the rainbow. I seriously believed this. And then I went to basics. Of course, my first thought was, well, obviously this is still part of the working stage because there's no end of this rainbow. My drill instructors were phenomenal. The second day I was in basics, and we'd been hollered out all day, he pulled me aside. We were not supposed to get phone calls. He told me, I can't give you a phone call, Fitzpatrick. That was my maiden name. He says, but I just want to let you know that your father came to Jesus. And I'm like, what? I didn't know what he meant there. Because in my mind, knowing my father, I figured that meant he was dead. I know what happened. And he looked at me and realized that he'd said it, you know, in a vernacular I was not clear with. Now, I was in the Deep South, and I came from New England. So I didn't know what a come to Jesus moment was. He said, no, no, he got AA. Mm-hmm. Well, what's AA? Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what that is? And I said, no. And he said, well, that means he stopped drinking. And I just kind of looked at him and I said, you told me that? And this is a very intimidating man. This man's like 6'5", huge man. And I remember feeling a kind of an outrage. Why are you telling me that? Do you know how many times my father stopped drinking? Why are you telling me that? Well, I'm in basics. And he says, no. He says, you don't understand. AA's different. Well, I didn't understand it, but thanks for telling me. Well, they really did pull me through a lot. They really looked out for me. And I was able to actually speak to them when I was having trouble. My father never broke to me while I was at basics. But then I got a letter about almost a year after I had been in the Army, and he asked me to please come home on my leave because he wanted me to attend a meeting. I didn't know what it was. I had never been. I sat in the front. It was my father's 1 year of sobriety, and I heard his story, his narrative. My brother was skeptical. He didn't speak to him. He wasn't speaking to him. He had good reason not to speak to him. He told me I was soft for speaking to him at all, but I told him I was trying to forgive. The forgiveness was coming, but it was my father's narrative that brought the understanding. When he stood up and told his story for the first time in his life, there were a couple of things that occurred to me. First of all, one of the other sharers had said, "We're only as sick as our secrets." And I remember sitting there feeling like I was in a wind tunnel. And I thought, wow, my family's got a lot of secrets. Every day was a secret. I should get an Oscar. Because I excelled at school, and everyone at school just thought my life was hunky-dory. But the truth was, I was raising my brother by myself. There were many days we had nothing to eat. Our electricity was turned off more than it was on. And we had days where there was no heat in our house. Nobody knew that. And that's the big secret. And to just interact with all your friends. But the truth of that was, I didn't tell the truth to anybody because I was afraid that the one thing I had left, my brother, would be taken away from me and we'd be separated. So I learned to keep quiet. I didn't lie, but I didn't tell anybody the truth. And when I sat in that AA meeting, my father told his story and I found out why he drank and the pain he had. He had accidentally killed his own brother. I didn't know that. I knew that my Uncle Timmy died. I knew that my Aunt Nancy died. And I knew that everybody was sad about it. But I didn't know that they had been wrestling. And my grandmother, not my father, his other two brothers had been wrestling, Timmy and Dennis. My grandmother yelled at him and told him to go upstairs and stop those two apes from making all that noise. He ran upstairs. He pushed them apart because he couldn't get them to stop. And when he pushed them apart, Timothy went into the bedpost. When he went into the bedpost, he vomited. He fell on his back, unconscious, and regurgitated at the same time. He aspirated his own vomit and died right there on the floor. The family was in chaos. My aunt came running up the stairs, who was my father's twin. My father's twin, you hear how close twins always are, right? Not these two. and she called him a murderer. And he started drinking. He was 15 and crippled. Did I leave out the fact that he was born with his legs backwards and he lived in Newington Children's Hospital? I also didn't know that. Nobody told me that. I knew he'd had surgeries, but I didn't know his legs were backwards, and I didn't know that he had a surgery almost every single year until he was 16 years old, and that he was in braces and his own twin sister wouldn't acknowledge him because he was a cripple. In those days, if you had a disability, there was just something wrong with you and the kids shunned you. You were not accepted. You were not given compassion, and you certainly weren't given your own teacher's aid to help you negotiate a hostile environment. So he grew up with that, but there were many other things that he talked about. But sitting there, hearing my father's narrative, I realized that it's not just my story. It's never just my story, because here's my brother right next to me living the same story, you think. The two of us, he could follow me. And you'll hear a lot of other different things from him that impressed him. Stories are not the same. We have to know each other's story. We have to hear each other's story. We have to brace each other for the authenticity. Because narrative without authenticity or context, you might as well just skip it. It doesn't help anything. We are the main character of our own stories. That's what I found out that day at the AA meeting. And it was the most spiritual experience I had, bar none, because it healed me. It healed my father. He's been sober for almost 30 years. I have the blessing of getting to know him. And since then, he has very bravely opened up and told me things that he didn't ever tell anybody. The more we speak, the better it gets. In my conversion story, I was attracted to the Book of Mormon because when I had the discussions with the missionaries, they happened to mention Heavenly Mother. In all of my searching, I was always searching for female deity, but I didn't know that's what I was searching for. I really, when I was in the Catholic faith, really loved Mary the Mother. In fact, my father sometimes used to call me Little Mary. Because that was what I wanted to be for Halloween every year. I want to dress up like Mary. I was seriously strange. Nobody had my costume. And I loved Mary Magdalene, and I loved hearing about the women around Christ. I always want to hear about that. And in catechism, I would always ask about that. Oh, but what about the women around the cross? And I got in serious trouble because when one of the nuns in catechism yelled at me, she told me, why do you always do this, Kimberly? You know, why don't you leave this class? You make it difficult every time. Why are you asking so many questions? And I said, well, sister, I just really want to know about, you know, this or the other thing. Every one of them annoyed her. It doesn't matter which one I pick. Because that was not the nature of faith. In those days especially. They weren't looking for inquiry. You're just supposed to swallow it all lock, stock, and barrel and get on with it. And that was not me. Never was me. But I got in trouble and ultimately thrown out because I had called the apostles a bunch of chickens because the women who supposedly didn't matter hung around and the apostles beat feet out of town. I was 9. So I think you see my spiritual path here. Always difficult, always interesting. I found Heavenly Mother, basically. I found her through the stories of the strong women in the Bible. I'm a little disappointed, I have to admit, in the Book of Mormon, because the only women that anyone talks about are the mothers of the stripling warriors, as if the only thing a woman could accomplish is to raise a bunch of soldiers to go and kill people. And they're faceless. They're nameless. So I can't really even identify with them. I can't even call them Ruth. I can't call them Esther. I have nothing. But I was so excited because this was the first faith that said, well, missionary said, well, we believe in Heavenly Mother. And he said that because I had so pitifully said, what about Mary? And he said, Mary's the mother of Christ. I said, yes, I know who she is. He's like, I'm just wondering if you do. I was a difficult investigator. I'm still friends with my missionaries. I'm sure that I'm their post-traumatic stress disorder investigator. I know I am from the state president. So I was excited. Then I was stunned, because the more I got in, I realized that only when you're an investigator is it okay to ask questions. And I kept conducting myself like an investigator. And do you know someone actually said that to me? The bishop's wife said to me, well, Kimberly, you're getting people upset because once you've been baptized, It's just assumed that you understand. I said, oh. And I looked at her, I said, do you? I said, because I'm looking for a mentor. She didn't have any answers for me. And I have been very honest in my sharing at church. I do include my Heavenly Mother in prayers. I don't go out there saying I think everyone else should. And I don't even say that I know she's there, because I don't know anything. I don't even know if she's separate from Heavenly Father. I have no idea. But in my narrative, I've experienced a few times where something particularly womanly is going on. Like when I had cancer. I had cancer of the uterus. And I was only 19 years old. And my cousin Ingrid had just died at age 35 of colon cancer. And I decided not to tell my family because they were all still freaked out. Ingrid had just been buried a little while ago and she was so young. Oh my, what were they going to say when they found out the 20-year-old had cancer? So I kept it to myself. I went through the course of treatments. And I can remember being in the bed by myself, just laying there after the specialist had told me, if we go in and we have to, we're going to take everything. And I said, so I won't have kids. And he said, no. I said, oh, okay. And in that night, as I was making the decision whether to have the surgery, I felt something distinctly feminine come to me. I can't describe it, really. I just knew that it wasn't the usual connection I had with Heavenly Father, which was very strong. I felt him there, like he was also supporting, but I felt like someone else had stepped in. I got through it. I'm here. I'm cancer-free. And after being told I was completely infertile after the surgery, I have 3 children. And 1 extra we took in. And I have felt her since. I like the Gnostic Gospels. I believed it fleshed out some of the things. I don't have any intimidation or problem in my story of looking for other stories. I think it fleshes things out. I mean, I can reject it. I don't have to agree with what everybody says, but I take it in, and it helped me a lot to read Gnostic Gospels. It also helped me a lot to be a nurse. I hear everybody's stories. And the one thing I found out through other people's narratives is nobody's different. Not really. We get pain. Predictable things happen from body to body. People feel things the same way. And they may happen in different order. They may happen in different circumstances. But I think I really started feeling like a true daughter of God. And that everyone was truly my brother and sister as I ministered to the people who were so sick. I work in critical care. And Heavenly Mother has helped me a lot in this task. And when I'm told I don't have the priesthood, I know inside I don't really believe that. My great-great-grandmother was an Indian shaman. She was a healer. I also didn't know that, so I didn't know that was part of my narrative until later. But when I asked my mother, gee, I wonder why there are 13 nurses in our family. And she said, oh, well, your great-great-grandmother was a shaman. What's a shaman? She says, a medicine woman. I was, oh, so I'd inherited something, I thought. And that was the first connection I'd felt to ancestors. And I feel that course through me, through the feminine side of me in healing. And that when I bless my patients and that when I touch them, I never touch them without bringing the divine into the equation. Because all the medical knowledge I have isn't enough, ever. So I bring her with me. And I don't have time to go into all of the experiences I've had around that, but just suffice it to say that it has informed my personal narrative of the power of the divine and that it's there for whoever opens up to it. I also want to say a quick thing about blogging and internet support groups and how those are narratives too. I am an enthusiastic feminine Mormon housewives contributor, commenter, and they are my sisters. And this is the first time I've come out to Sunstone, the first time I've met people that I've been talking to for years. And let me tell you, as soon as I got their name, I know their heart because I've been talking to them for years. I've been reading their stories. I read about when they lose their babies. I read about when they have their babies. I read about poop chronicles. I read about their struggles in faith. I found a home at FMH through their narratives because I found a cohort. Does it mean that all my problems are solved because I'm on a blog? No, I wouldn't make that claim. But I would say that something is solved when you find a common soul, when you find people in the same struggle. Doesn't matter where they are on the journey, but the fact they're on the same road makes it a lot less lonely while you try to figure it all out. So that's about all I have to say as far as narrative goes, and I'm going to leave it open to hear the next one to hear Joanna, because I'm just so privileged to have been here at Sunstone. I've enjoyed people so much. I have felt good. It's like coming to the blog, but everybody's here, not just FMH, but finding so many like-minded people. Your struggles may not be the exact same as mine, but the fact that you struggle and you talk about it, to me, is everything that AA taught my father. If you tell your story, it's going to be okay.
I told Sarah I knew this would be my favorite panel.
Smartest things I heard all weekend. I'm going to start with a confession about failure and shame. This is a paper that grows out of my experience over the last 2 years trying to write this memoir about growing up Mormon. A memoir which I cheekily draft titled The Book of Mormon Girl. It is a manuscript that sits on my hard drive. It's a manuscript that may never leave my hard drive. And that might be a good thing, I think, for reasons I'm going to try and explore today. When I wrote the opening pages, I tried to establish or describe the narrative context I was coming from. And here's how a couple lines of that sound. I grew up riding in fleets of blue-paneled family vans, bench seats loaded with children, all going to church in our play clothes on a Wednesday afternoon. Everything perfectly understood among us, all the lyrics memorized, nothing to be explained. I grew up in a world where all the stories I heard arrived at the same conclusions. The wayfarer restored, the sick healed, the lost keys found, a singular truth confirmed. And I'm referring in those lines, of course, to the strong narrative patterns we learn in Mormon tradition, in testimony meetings, in our Sunday school and primary classes, in The Friend. Stories that arc from certainty to certainty, from wholeness to wholeness. What place, I wondered, was there in such a world for a story like mine that arced from certainty through something that felt like exile and failure to the abandonment of certainty and finally to an unorthodox form of love for the tradition? And could I get it all down on paper, despite years of narrative discipline, not to reveal anything about myself that might suggest my unworthiness or embarrass my family or disqualify myself? Who would want a story like mine? Would telling it risk me the place in my community I so badly wanted? I did my best in writing The Book of Mormon Girl. 14 chapters, classic coming-of-age narrative about the Mormon tribal sensibility, Mormon families, our emphasis on perfection, Coke versus root beer, what Utah meant to me as a California Mormon, about one of the most formative books I've ever read, The Marie Osmond Guide to Beauty, Health, and Style. Oh, yes. About Mormon dance festivals, object lessons about chastity, girls' camp, polygamy, BYU, The Purge, Pioneer Day, Proposition 8, and making a new home in my own tradition. But as I sat with my first completed draft of the manuscript and shared it with a few friends, I felt that something was missing. Indeed, a gay Mormon friend who I shared the manuscript with observed, "You talk almost nothing of your marriage to your husband, David, even though the pressure to marry forms a steady drumbeat that undergirds the early part of the narrative." And I realized she was right.
And I realized, too, that with the story of falling in love with David, and I have an interfaith marriage, he's Jewish, I had left out the years I spent in Los Angeles during the late 1990s. As the slow-motion purge of Mormon feminists, gays, and lesbians and intellectuals continued, as the church embarked on its organized opposition to gay marriage, all of which I processed by acting out in ways that would shock no one in a non-Mormon audience, but which I find extremely hard to name or confess, even now, even to you. I thought in particular of one night during the very fall in 1993 when the church purged its first batch of feminist intellectuals. I was a 21-year-old girl, fresh out of BYU, living alone in Los Angeles, broken-hearted, sick with an undiagnosed neurological disorder that virtually erased the line between sleep and wakefulness, and how I found myself one night walking alone down Sunset Boulevard. The Santa Ana winds were blowing hot and dry, and the hills above Santa Monica were on fire, and we could see the fire lines from the city. And there I was alone, walking down Sunset Boulevard, and somehow I found myself in a tattoo shop with my shirt off. So strange, I was a virgin. And there was this strange man putting a big needle through a tender part of me that no one would ever see. It hurt. It hurt. And then how I wore my hurt under my clothes, because my heart, it hurt. Mormons! And that moment of utter vulnerability, aloneness, and exposure, it spoke volumes about those years and what they meant to me. But I had not been able to imagine saying that, even in my own memoir, and I can scarcely talk about it here. A few months after finishing my draft manuscript, I had the opportunity to hear Margaret Toscano talk about Mormon women's spiritual narratives at a Mormon feminist gathering near San Diego. Margaret talked about the underworld journey as a type of women's spiritual narrative, about the journeys of Eve and Persephone, the importance of the descent into darkness, all that it teaches us. And it struck me. I had written the descent into darkness completely out of my memoir. The dark night, hills on fire, illness, sleep, sadness, pain. Though those were glorious years, revelatory years, years of tremendous creativity, foolishness, wisdom, and import, they were years I could not bring myself to write down for fear of what I might expose about myself, for fear of the consequences and costs of that vulnerability and exposure. Since the 1960s and the rise of the consciousness-raising group, feminism has emphasized the importance of telling our stories as women to changing our outlook, our consciousness, and the world. When I left home and went to college at BYU, the stories just started coming out. In my own private notebooks, in my creative writing classes, in the feminist speakouts, and who invited the television cameras? My goodness. At those incredible first Take Back the Nights in Provo, I started to confess all the pressure and pain of growing up a smart, devout, dark-haired Mormon girl in a world with no use for people like me. I confessed childhood sexual abuse and emotional abuse. I confessed years of depression, and I confessed the incredibly confusing process of maturation, the soul puberty, I like to call it, I found myself in at that very moment. And in my early 20s, I even tried to speak out about or confess the great feelings of loss and anger I felt when the church fired, excommunicated, and discouraged the Mormon feminists I looked up to, my only plausible role models in the whole world. And then I stopped. For several years in the late 1990s and early 2000s, I quit Sunstone. In fact, this is my first full time back here since 1995. I hid out. I refused to write anything about Mormonism. Even when a friend asked me to write a scholarly essay on Terry Tempest Williams' refuge for a collection of essays on the literature of the Western U.S., I could scarcely bring myself to do it. It was the hardest piece of professional writing I have ever done. For about 10 years, fear of excommunication, for what, sat on my hands and choked my chest every time I sat down at the keyboard. I came slowly, slowly back to writing about Mormonism. First a private blog about interfaith family life, then a book manuscript about that, then a memoir attempt, and now I write about Mormon life and politics online for the public. I can write now only because I worked for 17 years to construct a life for myself where my daily bread, the roof over my head, and my most intimate relationships did not depend upon my status, my institutional status as a Mormon. Only by protecting myself against utter exposure and vulnerability is the writing even possible. I too look back on my 20s with an awareness of how little cover I had back then, how utterly, utterly exposed and vulnerable I was. As I wandered through Sunstone Symposia, and I joked with Lisa Butterworth, I was the Lindsay Lohan of Sunsworth, of Sunstone 93, 94, and 95. As I wandered through Sunstone Symposia and alone through the downtowns of big cities, crying out loud, literally, just walking around crying, trying to process the purge as it was happening. I had no career, I had no husband, I had no stable home in the world, and as some would have it, I had no home in my own church either. And my role models and mentors were so consumed mostly with their own struggles that they could really offer me no cover either. Even now, I'm aware of the need to protect myself against overexposure and unnecessary vulnerability. I don't read, for example, the comments on most of my online writing. My antenna are always up, and I feel very keenly each little misstep, each misplaced emphasis of tone, a little understatement, a little overstatement. Sometimes shame hits me in great waves, and I know it is shame that comes not from the writing, but from something much older and deeper, the shameful feeling that I have failed to be a good Mormon. The great feminist writer Muriel Rukeyser has said, if one woman told the truth about her life, the whole world would split open. I think about it now, and while I still believe in the world-rending power of our narratives as Mormon women, I think we have work to do on our own behalf to continue to create the consciousness that will allow us to work through and beyond shame, and to create the conditions that will allow a new generation of young Mormon women the cover they need as they make their own necessary and important spiritual journeys through the dark and the underworld. Shame. As I've gotten to know Jewish culture through my husband, I've seen the way other religious cultures deal with shame. In Yiddish, the word for shame is shanda. There's a great awareness of shameful behavior. That's a shanda, the saying goes. But there's also, in the healthier moments and aspects of the culture, a conscious desire to resist shame. Once during a pregnancy scare, before we were married, my husband said, well, it's not a shanda, right? It was a really important, it's not a shanda. It's important. There's a conscious desire to resist shame and to protect other people from shame. How can we as Mormon women create a greater cultural resistance to shame and protect each other from shame as we pass through the dark and underworld phases of our spiritual journeys? And this is a really important question to me, like, as a mother now. I've kind of crossed over, thank heavens, I'm no longer Lindsay Lohan. Crossed over kind of into my middle age years, and the main feeling I feel and felt coming here this year was, how do we provide cover for younger Mormons who are going through this? I'm grateful for the opportunity to be on this panel because it's given me a chance to be with and kind of reconnect with that overexposed 22-year-old. And to think about the cultural work we might need to undertake to create spaces of protection where our culture's young women can screw up and not feel ruined. Spaces of mercy where we can tell our stories in ways that do not compound our vulnerability. This session has been one of those spaces, and I thank you for that.
All right, we have about 5 minutes for questions or comments if you'd like to come up to the mic.
How about a group hug?
I know, I don't even know what to say after all that.
It's a 5-minute group hug. It seems extreme, but.
I have a question for Sarah about being outside the Mormons and yet loving the Mormons. And I think it's so fun to be loved by people that are not Mormon. I really like it, and I'm really curious what what you, how you feel or how much you care about other people who have been helpful and interested in Mormons and never been a member of the church, such as Janships or other, of course, there are notable such people in early Mormon history as well.
Fawn Brody. thanks, Trevor. I think I felt something like open up last night in the lecture. I think it was Tamara who introduced me to Jan and said, "Oh yeah, Sarah's like you." And I think with about 50 tons less education, but otherwise, yes, precisely. Exactly like that. I think, I talked to Janships a little bit about a Mormon studies program opening up at Wyoming and how, particularly if Sheila Taylor taught it, I'd be there every day, whether I had class or not. So I think there are so few of us non-Mormons attracted to that I don't think I've drawn any sort of community there. I think the greater part of my community just comes from mostly other Mormon feminists. But for my plumber, he's not a feminist, but he's Mormon, and I really like him. I try to talk to him about it every chance I get. I'll start hogging the time. I did want to make one little point. There was a gentleman here who, it's probably just a flinchy reaction to his heavy, educated British accent. He was sitting in front of me at an FMH panel, and he turned around and said, "So what is it, do you think, these housewives, these Mormon housewives, is it that they're bored? They have nothing else to do? Is that why they turn to blogging?"
Come a little closer.
And I got really, no, I wouldn't say that at all. I'd say that you're looking about, one PhD, two masters, and a couple people who could whoop your ass. So it's not a thing. They come to it from a sense of boredom. I think they're complicated people, just like everybody else. And just kind of into that, and then said, "So what is it, you do? What's your connection to this?" And he said, "Oh, I'm not a Mormon. I'm a sociologist." And I think, dear Lord, help me from ever becoming, "Oh, I'm not a Mormon. I'm a sociologist."
We just close all right. Amen.
Yes, I think that was a good ending. So thank you all for coming again, and we'll let you go to dinner.